This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's Friday. Shabbat Shalom, Jumma Mubarak, TGIF, and happy Passover. Happy Pesach is coming this weekend. So, but it being Friday, and this being the first hour of our program, as we have done for years and years and years and years and years, Senator Bernie Sanders, neither a Democrat nor a Republican, holding a national town hall here on our program every Friday, taking your calls, our Brunch with Bernie segment, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont. Bernie, can you hear me?
I can hear you great.
Okay, wonderful. Before we get into anything else, the main topic of conversation on this program, and I think all across talk radio yesterday, was the debates. And it wasn't so much what was said or not said by either Senator Clinton or Senator Obama, but by what was said by the narrators. And in fact, Stephen Colbert did a little funny on this. If I can just play you a clip. This is Stephen Colbert from the Colbert Report last night. If I can make it work. Hang on just a second.
Last night was the Pennsylvania Democratic debate on ABC. The night was a huge success. To begin with, for moderator, ABC courageously chose George Stephanopoulos, who owes his career to the fact that he was Bill Clinton's communications director, so he was objective in the sense that everybody knew his bias. Listen to how he went after Senator Clinton about a conversation where she said Obama couldn't win the general election.
I'm not going to ask you about that conversation. I know you don't want to talk about it.
She doesn't want to talk about it. Enough said. Let's move on.
Enough said. Let's move on. So, Bernie, your thoughts on this?
Well, two thoughts. I'm going to be on the Colbert Show on Monday night.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Well, you're looking forward to it. I'm not sure that I'm looking forward to it, but
he'll be good to you. He's a good guy.
We'll see what happens. I am really glad that the American people have begun to speak out about that farce of a debate and what ABC did. And it's just terribly important that we continue to focus on issues like that, because I will tell you, McCain is going to become president of the United States if the corporate media continues to act like that and to deflect attention away from the real issues facing the American people. I think they went something like 45 minutes before they got on anything away from gossip and innuendo and all this other crap to discussing the real issues that the American people are dealing with every single day. And if they continue to do that, I worry very much about the election. If you start talking about why is the middle class collapsing and what the candidates have to say, Republicans have nothing to say. If you talk about why we are the only nation in the industrialized world without a national health care program and the need for universal health care, Republicans have nothing to say. If you talk about the fact that we have given hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, despite the fact that we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any country, major country on earth, Republicans have nothing to say. If you talk about global warming and the fact that we are the laughing stock of the world in terms of not responding to global warming, Republicans have nothing to say. But if you don't talk about those issues, and if you worry about why Barack Obama doesn't wear an American flag on his lapel, this or that about Hillary Clinton, you know what, they will win the election. And what we have got to demand, and it was really gratifying to hear the American people stand up and say, we're tired of that crap. We're tired of your gossip and your gotcha questions. This country is in serious trouble. The middle class is collapsing. Our healthcare system is falling apart. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty. We want government to start responding to those issues and not your absurd games that you continue to play. So I thought, actually, after all is said and done, that the results were good in that the American people gave a very clear message to ABC and hopefully to the other networks that we want serious discussion of serious issues.
Amen. And also, you know, honoring the fact that on Monday night, you, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be on the Colbert Report. Last night, Stephen Colbert had Barack Obama on, and if I may play 22 seconds of that, I think you'll find it germane to this conversation. Okay with you?
Sure.
Here it is.
Now, I enjoyed the debate last night, sir, though I have to take issue with you calling some of the questions manufactured political distractions.
Well, Stephen, I think the American people are tired of these games and petty distractions.
Well, sir, speaking for the news media... sir, speaking for the news media, I can tell you we are not tired of it. It allows us to ask the same questions over and over again, and we don't have to do any more work.
Well,
bingo.
That I think Obama's statement was right on, and I think Colbert was very funny. The media is not tired about it. And here's what else is going on. Number one, of course, there is a reason for this. There's a reason why in my long career in politics, I have yet to be asked the question by a reporter. I've been interviewed hundreds of times. Not one reporter has come up to me and said, Bernie, what are you going to do about the national disgrace that we have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world? No reporter has ever asked me that.
You mean never in like 20 years of
never
politics?
Never in 20 years. It's just not a question you're allowed to ask. It's just, on the other hand, I mean, I was asked a million. I've been asked what kind of underwear I wear, you know, and so forth and so on. But not that question. No one has ever asked me, do you think it is moral or appropriate that the richest 1% in America own more wealth than the bottom 90%? It's just not a question that the media is going to ask, because it's owned ultimately by large multinational corporations who do not want to raise these issues. And the other problem that you have is that with the decline, for example, of network news, with the decline of newspapers, many of them are cutting back financially on their reporting capabilities. So they don't even have the staff to do serious economic research. They don't have the staff to cover Latin America or Africa. So what are you going to do? What you do is a poll on the campaign, right? And the poll today said Clinton was not Obama, and you can talk about that. And it's very cheap and easy to talk about gossip. You got three pundits up there and to discuss the burning issue about the Reverend Wright. Well, you know, last I heard, Reverend Wright was not running for president, or all this other stuff. Because it's hard. I mean, you know, to get some serious economists to talk about, is our trade policy with China working, or is it costing us good-paying jobs and lowering our wages? You know what? You got to know a little bit about economics and a little bit about trade. It costs some money to find people to do that. So it's easier and cheaper to talk about gossip. But bottom line is, we have got to, and the bottom line is that shows like yours and other progressive shows, and what Colbert does, and what Jon Stewart does, and what we're beginning to see a little bit more of, is just terribly, terribly important. Because you heard the response when Obama made his statement on the Colbert Show. And I think the people there in that audience who were responding very positively to what Obama was saying, they're all over America. They're sick and tired of the distraction. They want real... You know, we understand honest people can have disagreements about the economy, health care, education. Let's discuss those issues. Let's move this country forward.
Yeah, amen. And perhaps we should be discussing, or perhaps Congress should be discussing once again, post-Reagan doing away with the Fairness Doctrine in 87 and Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act in 96.
Absolutely.
Perhaps we should be discussing programming in the public interest.
Absolutely. It is, you know...
Real news.
Many of us have cable TV, and we flip around to 50 stations, and it is hard to come by good shows. Now, as it happens, having said that, just the other day, I want to tell you, I did see something that I thought was really good on the PBS on Frontline. They did a show on, they had a very good reporter whose name I don't know, kind of personable guy, who went to Germany, he went to Switzerland, he went to Taiwan, he went to Japan and elsewhere looking at healthcare systems. And it was really a good report. And bottom line is, in all of these countries, they spend significantly less per person on healthcare than we do. In all of these countries, the infant mortality rate is lower, longevity is, I believe, longer in all of those countries.
Yes.
And they cover all of their people. And everybody in those countries thinks, even the most conservative people, that, of course, universal health care is where we have to be. And it was good for the American people to see that. But we see it much too rarely.
Yeah. Well, I started in this business. I started out as a DJ for the first 3 years, but I ended up at that same radio station, WITL, in Lansing, Michigan, which was the number one station in the city. It's a media market. doing news for 7 years. And that news operation, we had five people in the newsroom of a small local radio station. And that newsroom lost money, but it was the cost of keeping the license.
Well, Tom, we saw the same thing here in Burlington, Vermont, and in the state of Vermont. When I was mayor of the city of Burlington from 81 to 89, we had a number of radio stations in the area, locally owned, who took news seriously. That's all gone now.
Yeah, it's all gone because the rules have changed. I mean,
right.
It's very straightforward. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. He'll be taking your questions next. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Common sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Clean air, blue sky, will they be here when I die? Tall trees, white snow, will they be here when I go?
21 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. His website, by the way, and he's got a great newsletter over there, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for it. It's free. He's just send it out to you in email periodically. And Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Mike in Montana, listening on Sirius. You are live with Senator Bernie Sanders. Hey, Mike. You're on the air. You're on the air, Mike.
Hello,
Mike. You gotta turn off your radio and listen to the telephone. Let's go to Scott in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Scott.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
I saw the exact same show that you saw. First of all, and we have to be really honest here too. I'm a complete diehard Democrat. I will preface that. But okay, you tell me what happened with the Japanese healthcare system and what's happening with that. What's the real story? With the universal health care thing going on.
But the real story is, according to...
Tell me what it is.
Is that they are covering all of their people, and they do it at a fraction of the cost that we do it. Does the Japanese health care system or the Canadian health care system or the British health care system have problems? Of course they do. Every system in the world has problems. But we end up spending twice as much per person on health care. We have 47 million people who are uninsured. Our costs keep soaring. And our results are not particularly good in terms of longevity or infant mortality. The goal of the American healthcare system is not to provide quality care to all at the lowest possible cost. The goal is to make as much money as possible for the insurance companies, for the drug companies, and for the medical equipment suppliers. So we have a lot to learn from the national healthcare programs that exist all over the world. Now, what you see in the media here is people say, well, they got a problem in Canada. It's right. They do have a problem in Canada. They got a problem in England. We have problems. We have millions who can't afford it, millions who are underinsured, and our costs keep going. Can we do better? Should we guarantee health care to all people? Yes. And study after study shows that if we move toward a single-payer system, which I believe should be administered at the statewide level, we can provide quality, comprehensive care to all people without spending any more than we're spending right now.
Frank in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Frank, you're live with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, Senator Sanders, is it possible for you to sponsor some kind of legislation to prevent the government from privatizing all the services? We're being triple taxed. We're taxed to build something, then we're taxed to maintain that item, and then they sell it to the private sector, and we're taxed to use it. And also, we need some legislation to prevent the president from pardoning people that have never been convicted of a crime, like Bush Sr. He pardoned the five usual suspects, and they were never convicted. They were never even charged with the crime.
Well, let me just say about government privatization, Frank. Tom Hartman talks about this all of the time. What Bush and his friends believe in is that government should play a virtually no role in improving the lives of people, that we should privatize almost every sector of our society. And Bush has had a plan to substantially do away with government employees and move them over to private contractors. We've run into this problem very seriously in the state of Vermont. We even know that in the military now, you're seeing companies like Blackwater at much greater expense doing the work that U.S. soldiers used to do and do better and more cost-effectively. And that's part of the Bush plan. And I think what Frank is also talking about is you have states around this country who are beginning to sell their roads, their water systems, to private companies as well, which is, to my mind, a pretty dumb idea. So we have worked. We have legislation in, for example, to stop the privatization efforts in the military, and I certainly am somebody, as a former mayor, as a congressman, as a senator, who believes that long-term, the best way to deliver public services is through a well-trained, well-paid public employment where people take pride in their work.
And they know they're going to have a pension when they retire and they're going to stay. Like the post office is a great example of this. You know, I don't want the pizza delivery guy, the guy who was the pizza delivery guy last week, delivering my checks and my credit records this week.
Well, we saw that, Tom, in terms of airport security. That before 9/11, the people who were doing airport security were paid, in some cases, minimum wage. Turnover was phenomenally high. Training was minimum. I think when you, especially if you're dealing with terrorism and so forth, you want well-trained people who see their jobs as a career. And because when you do that, you prevent kinds of turnover that you have when you contract out. In the long run, you save money, and I think you have better quality service.
Right, and this is the difference between a private corporation whose only goal is profit. By law, it has to be their only goal, their primary goal, and a government agency or a nonprofit whose primary goal is to deliver the service that they're mandated to deliver. And, you know, it just gets right down to that. We've got to take a break here in just another 15 seconds, Bernie. But I think that this issue of privatization, it even goes to our vote. We've privatized our vote now. We're
Absolutely.
Handing it over to these corporations.
I mean, if people really believe that we should continue to privatize so that ExxonMobil and the big insurance companies can run this country even more than they do, well, I have a disagreement with that thought.
Yeah, then they should become Republicans, because that's the Republican platform, I guess. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our brunch with Bernie, 866-303-2270, taking your phone calls, TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for the all-new and redesigned website there. The stream is now working, by the way, 27 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Keep walking, keep on your toes, and don't stop.
A fine idea it is. Welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. Find out more at teamster.org. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. It's our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls. His website, sanders.senate.gov. And Ernie in Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Hey, Ernie?
Hello?
You're on the
yes.
air.
Yes. Senator Sanders, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Ernie.
Hey, what I wanted to know is, are there any figures available for how many people are losing their homes in Japan, Canada, England?
Well, interesting
that they have national health care systems.
Well, that's a very interesting point that Ernie raises, because one of the issues that this guy from the PBS asked wherever he went, he said, well, tell me, he goes to the guy in Japan, he says, how many people go bankrupt because of health care costs? And the Japanese guy looked at him in bewilderment. He didn't understand what he was talking about, and the answer, of course, is zero. So in the United States, bankruptcy, at least, is certainly one of the major causes of bankruptcy, is these very large health care bills that people simply cannot afford to pay. That does not exist, needless to say, where you have national health care programs. Furthermore, from a business point of view, what you see in America is both large and small businesses put a huge amount of their resources into providing health care for their workers, and as the economy declines, we're seeing a decline in that type of coverage, but it also means that they're not investing in where they should be investing in their businesses, as opposed to putting money into health care for the employees, a problem that does not exist where you have national health care.
Yeah, amen. Mike in Montana, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Mike? Hello?
Mike, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Am I there?
Yes, Mike.
Okay, a few years back, Senator Sanders was talking about environment in D.C. on your show.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, who do you see more suitable to change that environment in D.C., Senator Obama or Senator Clinton? Keep in mind that Senator Clinton is the one who was laying bricks for the same environment while she was working in the Walmart. So what's she going to do when she's going to get there? She's going to apply herself fully and make a legal and democratic appearance of this wall that you call Walmart. And Barack Obama is the only chance to change that environment. I want to hear your opinion and Senator Sanders from the air, if it's possible.
Okay. Well, here's my opinion. As an independent, I am not involved in the Democratic primary. I will strongly support either Obama or Clinton. I know both of them. And after all is said and done, and after all the media hype and the conduct of the campaign and so forth, in terms of their policies, they're both fairly close together. They'll both be, I suspect somewhere, between a moderate to a liberal Democrat. Not as progressive as I would like to see, but a hell of a lot better than where George Bush and McCain would take us. In terms of environment, I serve on the Energy Committee with Senator Clinton, and she has been quite strong on issues dealing with the environment. We work together on a green jobs program which passed, which will train people to do work in solar, wind, geothermal, and other sustainable energies. Obama has also been very strong on the issue. And I think one of the clear differences that you will see, whoever is elected president, whether it's Obama or Clinton, is a radical change in how we deal with environmental issues, where Bush has been, I think, without debate, the worst environmental president in the history of this country. His father was not bad, actually. And compared to his father, he is way, way, way off the mark. And what you will also see, I think, in both of those candidates, Obama and Clinton, is an understanding that as you move away from fossil fuel, as you move to energy efficiency, as you move to solar, wind, geothermal, we can create huge numbers of jobs. If you build a mass transportation system, we can create jobs right here in the United States. I think on environmental and global warming issues, big change if a Democrat is elected to the White House.
Yes, indeed. Morris in Laguna Woods, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. How are you, Senator?
Good. How are you, Morris?
I am fine. I live in a retirement community of about 18,000 people. I'm a World War II veteran, a non-combatant, a weather observer for 3 years. Now, in Iraq, we hear as a result of what's going on, that troops, men, women, are being sent back time after time after their so-called terms of
deployment
in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the complaint is that we don't have enough soldiers and Marines and sailors and so forth. I'm concerned about the possibility of a Republican administration, which is a potential, but I hope not going to happen, coming in and trying to initiate or start again the draft. Now, I have 5 grandchildren, all of whom would probably be eligible for the draft. Now, with the civil protests, which would probably result as a result of any attempt to institute again the draft, these two are linked. Besides the possible use of mercenaries like Blackwaters to quell civil protests. The two are linked.
Yes. Well, this is what I think, Morris. I think you raise a number of important issues. Number one, this redeployment where soldiers have been sent over there once, twice, three times, clearly has caused enormous stress on the military. Just a study, I think, in the newspaper yesterday, where hundreds of thousands of these men and women are coming back with depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and just exhaustion. And that is one of many, many reasons why this war has got to be ended, not only that it's costing us $12 billion every single month that we should be spending here, but it is doing a heck of a job on our military. This military today is just stretched as thin as it possibly can be. Now, you raised the question about a draft. The problem that a president has, if he wants to bring forth a draft at a time when you have an unpopular war, is that it would likely, and I suspect very likely, bring forth revolts on campuses and working-class areas all over this country. What Bush has managed to do in sustaining now into our 50th year of the war, he has done this by giving, by not paying for the war, for a start. So he is simply letting our kids and grandchildren pay for it by adding it to the national debt. And the other thing he has done is not had a draft in which, you know, ordinary people have got to fight it. And that has calmed down the campuses and so forth. So I think a president who brought forth a draft in the middle of an unpopular war would be making a very, very big political mistake. And I don't think he would do it. But having said all of that, what we have got to do now is end this disastrous war. We've got to focus on the real enemies that we have out there, Al-Qaeda, international terrorism. We have to do this militarily, but we also have to do it non-militarily. And it is just a real obscenity that we are forcing our children and grandchildren to pay for this war because George W. Bush doesn't have the guts to ask the people today to pay for the war that he started.
Yeah, amen. Mitch in Tacoma, Washington, listening to Talk 1090, KPTK. Hey, Mitch.
Hey, good morning, both of you. Welcome from the great gray Pacific Northwest.
Hey, Mitch, how are you?
Listen, last week we learned that the principals were gathering in the Situation Room of the White House to discuss specific torture techniques that were going to be used on prisoners. Then on Friday we learned that President Bush not only knew about these meetings, but he approved of them. Well, I've sent emails to both of my senators and to my congressman asking about this, and of course I've gotten no response. What I want to know is there anybody in the Congress that cares enough about what's going on in our country to even speak out about this, let alone actually do anything about it?
Well, Mitch, you know, one of the things that is very sad is that a lot of Americans ask the same questions that you do. Nobody in Congress is doing, I don't hear anything about it. The truth is, you know, for a variety of reasons, the American people are not getting through the media some of the reality that's going on in Congress. So if the question is, are people speaking out against torture? Yes, they are. There are many senators, many members of the House who are doing everything that we can to make sure that the United States of America is no longer identified with torture. That is just horrendous for a thousand different reasons. So sometimes you may not hear about what some of us are trying to do, but if the question is, are some of us doing our best to make sure that the United States ends all torture, shuts down Guantanamo Bay, the answer is yes, we are.
John Conyers is holding hearings on this, right?
John is, among other things, Chairman Conyers is holding hearings. It's been discussed in the Senate numerous times. Legislation has come up. You know, you got a president who, again, I think certainly is the worst president in the modern history of this country, is clearly responsible for so lowering our standards all over this world that is just a horror show.
It's our Brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders with us here on the Tom Hartman program. Our number 866-303-2270, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, sanders.senate.gov. If you want to pick up Senator Sanders' website and his regular newsletter, you can sign up for it. And, of course, airamerica.com for the newly redesigned website. 45 after.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Radio. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, Senator Bernie Sanders with you. answering your questions at 866-303-2270. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Ours, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room or participate in those blogs. And the newly redesigned airamerica.com. And the stream is now working. Susan in Seattle, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Susan in Seattle, that's me?
That's you.
Oh, okay. I couldn't hear you. I have a very complex question to ask Senator Sanders. Both Obama and Clinton have talked about bringing the troops home within the first 12 to 14 months, which is all very good. But in the meantime, we have these huge – this is a long question, so let me just say it. We have these huge contracts that have just been – renewed and, in fact, reinforced with more money for Blackwell, Halliburton, Bechtel, all these corporations who are ostensibly providing security. We don't know what that means. What do you mean security? But they're providing security. We have pretty much created under this administration a mercenary force. We have already created a force that is there on the ground, almost in equal numbers to the army that we have sent.
So your question, Susan.
Is, if they do bring all these men home, what are we doing? Are we leaving them there, and are we adding more? And
I got your question, Susan. I think you're asking as well. You can bring the U.S. military home, are we going to continue to leave 140 or 150,000 people in private contracts still there? That's your question, right?
Presumably.
Yeah. Okay, and the answer is obviously no. And when we talk about bringing the troops home, we talk about ending these contracts as well. It would be absurd to bring home people in the military and yet maintain a mercenary army in Iraq. So to answer Susan's question, that's what people mean when they say bring the troops home. It means ending these contracts as well. And while we're on that subject, you know, one of the issues that I intend to take a hard look at with some other senators is just these outrageous no-bid contracts that have been given to these companies in Iraq where they're ripping off the United States taxpayer. And also, by the way, above and beyond the war in Iraq, people are not talking much about the fact, Tom, we spend an well over $500 billion a year on the military in general. This is above Iraq and Afghanistan. And why we end up spending so much money and
it's half our discretionary budget, I believe.
That's right. It is a little bit over half of the entire discretionary budget. How much of that money is actually being spent to fight international terrorism as opposed to sustaining weapon systems that were developed to fight the Soviet Union? How much waste and fraud, of which we know there is a huge amount, within the military. And we're beginning to document some of that. But when we take a hard look, as we must, against waste and fraud, in all agencies of the government, we can't exempt the military from that. And I have a feeling, there is just many billions of dollars being spent there that should not be.
Yeah. Mary in Salem, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. I pushed the wrong button. Todd in South Dakota, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator.
Hi, Todd.
Say, is there a website I can go to find out more on the single-payer health care system?
Sure. There are many. Probably the best one that comes to my mind is Physicians for National Health Care Program.
Which is PNHP.org, I believe, although you can Google it.
And there are some physicians there who have been advocating it for years, very knowledgeable about what's going on in America and, in fact, around the rest of the world.
Yeah, I gave the keynote at their annual speech 5 years ago, I think it was. Your friend of mine, Deb, Dr. Deb from Montpelier, and I went out there.
That's right.
Anyway, Mary in Salem, Oregon. Let's get back to Mary.
Yes, hi. You're giving me a little bit of hope here. I'm wondering if you've read Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
I have, actually.
You have, yeah. How we meddle in other countries'
governments.
Okay, well, I'm wondering what, you know, a lot of us want to do something, but we don't know what to do as citizens. You know, they say, well, what can we do about the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq?
Okay, Mary, I mean, a simple question, but maybe the most important question, and I hear it in Vermont a whole lot of times. And let me give you a very simple and straightforward answer. I think we have to break out of the mode of behavior that we very often have, and that we have to start reaching out to our friends and our neighbors, and even more importantly, try to reach out to people who may not agree with us on every single issue. One of the things that Bush and Karl Rove have been very successful about is dividing up working people on issues like gay rights or guns or all these other things, or abortion. And what we have got to do is sit down and reach out and say to working people, listen, do you think that as a country we can do better than we're doing right now? Let's talk about it, issue by issue. Let's try to get meetings with our members in Congress or our senators. Let's provoke discussion. I mean, Mary, if you did nothing more than got three or four people registered to vote in the coming election who otherwise would not vote, you will have expanded your influence by 400%. And sometimes it's just so simple that we forget to do it. The vast majority of the people, in my view, in this country, want to move America in a very different way. And the other side has the money, but we have the people. But we have to learn how to use our power as citizens. So that means just reaching out, organizing, holding meetings, going to your city council, get them to pass resolutions, taking on the media where you can. So there's just an enormous amount of grassroots work that can be done.
Yeah. And setting up town halls and then inviting your member of Congress.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well done. As you do these all over Vermont constantly.
We're doing three of them tomorrow.
Three of them? I am not surprised. Bernie Sanders, the Energizer Bunny of politics. Sanders.Senate.gov. Thanks, Bernie.
Thank you, Paul.
Anything Goes Friday, coming up next.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. It's Friday. We're going to do our Anything Goes Friday here today for the next 2 hours, taking your calls on any topic you want to talk about. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. First, I would like to seed this. I'd just like to drop one topic out there. And that has to do with the media and what's going on with the media. Particularly, I think this has been brought to light by what happened with the ABC debates day before yesterday and the response to it. MoveOn.org over at obviously at their website, MoveOn.org, has a petition that you can sign. I signed it yesterday, basically saying, here's the petition text, debate moderators abuse the public trust every time they ask trivial questions about gaffes and gotchas that only political insiders care about. Enough with the distractions. ABC and other networks must focus on issues that affect people's daily lives. End of quote. And, in fact, not only did I sign it, but afterwards I gave him $25. I strongly encourage people to go over there and do that. We have seen such a change in this country, and I've seen it in my lifetime. I started in this business, in the radio business, in 1968 at the age of 17. I was I started in campus radio at Michigan State University about a year before that. I can't remember the station, but Newberry Hall. Was it Campbell Hall? Fee Hall! So it would be WFEE. In any case, I made a tape after doing campus radio for 3-4 months, made a tape, took it around all the radio stations in Lansing, Michigan, got a job as a part-time country western DJ at WITL, ended up being a full-time country western DJ, then went from there to WVIC where I did all-night album cuts, progressive rock, and then I did morning drive, Drake format, you know, shouting over the music kind of thing, and a really tight, really fast beat. And then I went back, and then I went to news. And after 3 years of being a DJ, and for the next 7 years, I did news back at WITL. And, in fact, oddly, just about a year ago, I got an email from Chuck Mefford. His airmate name was Chuck Drake, who used to be the owner of that station. And he used to do an afternoon talk show. And this was during the time when the Fairness Doctrine was in effect. Reagan suspended it in 87, but this was 1968 to 1978. I was in this business. And during those 10 years... working in news, we had this was a local radio station in the Lansing market, Michigan, Lansing, Michigan, a town at that time of maybe 250,000 people. It was the capital of the state. But nonetheless, there were a whole bunch of radio stations This station, being the country and western station, was the number one station in town. But nonetheless, it was, you know, a small local station. And we had five people in our news department. Our news department lost money because that was the cost of keeping the radio station licensed. That was the cost to do that to the radio station, because you had to program in the public interest. Now, that was one part of the Fairness Doctrine. Another part of the Fairness Doctrine was that if you gave one side of a debate, of a political debate, time, you had to give it to another side. A third part was that, you know, part of programming in the public interest was also giving free time to politicians. Now, I think that the free time to politicians part is something that we should be seriously looking at, and the programming of public interest is a part, is a piece of this that we should be seriously looking at. I frankly am not in favor of bringing back the Fairness Doctrine of equal time. And the problem is, and here's why, because I worked in radio when that was the case, and occasionally worked on that talk show in the afternoon, the Chuck Drake Show, and you couldn't, as a consequence of that, we never went near politics. You know, we'd talk about, you know, how do you get the squirrels out of your attic? Because there was all this concern that the other side would yell and scream and they'd invoke the Fairness Doctrine, all this kind of thing. So I think that instead of talking about balancing radio, we need to be talking about programming in the public interest. Is the public being served by the programming that's being provided? Is democracy being served by the programming that's being provided? And the way that, and between Reagan's suspension of the Fairness Doctrine in 87 and Bill Clinton signing the Telecommunication Act in 1996, we've basically just kicked all this stuff out. And after Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in 96, I remember when CBS said, okay, our news division is no longer separate and it's no longer losing money after all those years. And guys like Walter Cronkite, who made, you know, he made a good salary, but he wasn't making the equivalent of millions of dollars a year like the TV stars who do news do now. He was making, you know, he was the upper end of the middle class. He was doing very well, but, you know, I don't know what it would be in today's dollars, maybe $100,000, $150,000, a couple hundred thousand dollars a year at the most. And that, you know, let's go back to saying programming in the public interest is a desirable thing. This, remember the old movie Network? I mean, Howard Beale, it was prophetic. It was absolutely prophetic.
You guys say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Perhaps the most embarrassing performance by the media in a major presidential debate in years is how editor and publisher, which is a very high status, very seriously considered publication, spoke of this debate. And, you know, I played it during Bernie's show. I think it certainly bears playing again. Stephen Colbert talking about George Stephanopoulos. I mean, it was just absolutely, absolutely terrible.
Last night was the Pennsylvania Democratic debate on ABC. The night was a huge success. To begin with, for moderator, ABC courageously chose George Stephanopoulos, who owes his career to the fact that he was Bill Clinton's communications director, so he was objective in the sense that everybody knew his bias. Listen to how he went after Senator Clinton about a conversation where she said Obama couldn't win the general election.
Which actually should be a very important question to ask, you would think, right? Here's what Stephanopoulos said to Senator Clinton.
I'm not going to ask you about that conversation. I know you don't want to talk about it.
She doesn't want to talk about it. Enough said. Let's move on. Besides, it would have taken time away from asking Obama this.
Do you think Reverend Wright loves America as much as you do?
He followed up with an equally pressing question. Could God create a rock so heavy that he himself could not know you're a secret Muslim?
Yeah. I mean, this is what it has descended to, that our comedy shows are providing more news than our news shows. And news used to be this sacred thing. It used to be sacrosanct. It used to be. I remember when I worked in news at WITL and ultimately I was also a program director for a year at the end of all that at WNBY. I remember when I worked in news and also as a program director, news people were not allowed to talk, even literally to talk to the salespeople on the radio station. You did the news. It didn't matter if an advertiser was in trouble. It didn't matter what was going on in the world that might influence economically the radio. The news was the news. and sales was sales. People think that that programming in the public interest dimension of the Fairness Doctrine was all about public service announcements. And, in fact, back in the day, radio stations used to play public. So, yes, there's going to be a meeting of the Grange tonight at 7 o'clock at Grange Hall, and or the VFW's meeting, you know, those kind of things. Yes, we did those things in radio. And to some very small extent, we did those things because that was part of the Fairness Doctrine stuff that Reagan suspended in 87 that, you know, was required. That was the community service part. But I would submit to you, and I've never seen actual numbers on this. I don't think that anybody's ever actually quantified it. But I would submit to you that easily 90% of the way that radio and television stations complied with those provisions to program in the public interest of the Fairness Doctrine was not by reading public service announcements, but instead was by providing real news and actually talking about the issues. People ask the question, you know, how did America get so dumbed down? How is it that we're getting our best information, literally our best political information, from shows like Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart, from the Comedy Channel? And I'm not saying that's bad. I watch these things every night. I want to know what's going on in the world. But why is it that the news is not being discussed on the news? Why is it that the news is all about, well, there was a calf born today with two heads? Some guy in Winooka, whatever, just went on a shooting rampant. Well, that's a local story. That's not a national story. Oh, we've got some Mormons, fundamentalist Latter-day Saints who have been busted for polygamy. Let's do wall-to-wall coverage for the next 4 days. Well, you know, if you live in the neighborhood, arguably you can even say, okay, maybe this is a national story, but 24/7? 24/7? I mean, at a certain point, don't we all have to say enough already? People are losing their jobs. There's no place for them to go. They're losing their health care if they have pre-existing conditions. There's nothing that can be done about it. Under John McCain's health care proposals, he would not qualify for health care because he had cancer before and he has a pre-existing condition. Or if he did get health care and he got cancer again, he would not be covered. They'd throw his butt out of the system. Shouldn't we be talking about these things? We'll be picking up your calls right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocky was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Anything goes Friday. Whatever you want to talk about, you can set the agenda. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, our website if you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com's website, newly redesigned as well. And Louise says I should warn you. I've been drinking this Viso energy drink. I think that there's a sponsor on KPOJ here, our local station. And I just noticed after drinking a little more than half the bottle that there is a warning. Warning, this contains more caffeine than 3 cups of coffee. And so if I seem to be talking a little fast now, you know what's up. Deborah in Albany, California. Hey, Deborah, what's on your mind today? Your well-caffeinated host is with you.
I could tell.
Thank you.
Listen, I was furious to hear that KBR paid zip in taxes and Halliburton's gone to Dubai, and so I'm wondering if the Democrats would have the cojones, and I do believe they should always put legislation on the floor, whether they have 60 votes or not.
I agree.
To require withholding, like working people pay, from payment on such huge military contracts, et cetera, to recoup the appropriate amount of federal taxes on that contract, regardless of where the corporation is based, to defeat this offshoring tax cheating.
Well, I think there's a simpler way to do it, and that's simply to say that we will not give taxpayer dollars to any corporation that is not an American corporation and a U.S. taxpayer.
Either way is fine with me. And let me say a bit about the media business. I confess I do not pay for cable And I was very upset that a lot of the debates were not accessible on network TV. So I made it a point to watch channels, the ABC thing.
Right.
And I was furious. I refused to watch that station anymore. And I don't know how to eliminate the stooge questioners, but there's got to be a way to get more substance.
Well, go over to moveon.org.
I'm going to sign that. Thank you for telling us about that.
You're welcome, and thank you for your call, Deborah. I mean, they're leading the charge on this thing and doing a fine job of it. Joan in Montana. Hey, Joan, what's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about and tell you a little story about the health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
When it first came out, I went to the doctor's office with my doctor bill and said to the receptionist, how come my office visit has gone up in price? And she said to me, Joan, you're not going to pay any more than you always did. We'll get the other $2 from the insurance company. So basically, as a patient, it was not a benefit to me to have health insurance. They still charged me the same amount of money and got the difference from the health insurance company. So
right. And eventually, by the way, you are going to pay that extra $2, because where do you think the health insurance company is going to get the money to pay the doctor? They're going to get it by raising your rates.
And, you know, it's the biggest welfare situation, and it's just multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. And so we have people who cannot get treated because they don't have health insurance, because they do have health insurance and have a pre-existing condition. So the only benefit is to the health companies and the doctors, and I find this just an appalling situation.
I agree. Although
it's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. Although I would exempt the doctors to a large extent from that. I think that many of them, and I have several friends who are docs. Many of them are victims of this system as much as anybody else. It's the health insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, and the for-profit hospitals. You know, Bill Frist's daddy became one of the 20 or 100 richest men in America. Became a multi-billionaire with a B by buying up formerly not-for-profit small hospitals and small healthcare facilities and turning them into for-profit facilities, paying minimum wage, squeezing the blood out of them, and he literally became a billionaire that way. And it's wrong. PJ in Connecticut. Hey, PJ, what's up?
Yeah, I'm calling with regard to the Mark Penn and Charlie Black Association, and I don't understand why the media isn't making a little more of this.
For our listeners who don't know, Charlie Black is in charge of John McCain's campaign. Mark Penn is in charge, or was in charge, of Hillary Clinton's campaign. Charlie Black is the head of a company which is owned by Mark Penn's company.
Correct.
They're both lobbyists and PR guys.
DKSH is owned by Burson Marsteller, so they want two horses in the race. So they're going to be pushing Hillary to stay in, because they would dearly love to have two horses in the race. And as long as she's in the race, they're being paid. So, I mean, they have McCain in the race through BKSH, and as long as she's still running, they're still making money off of her. So, you know, it's just a money thing. And, you know, I don't think she's stupid. She'd like to be the other horse.
Well, I think that she's hired them because they're good, and that's the same reason that John McCain has. But this is a serious question, and of all the questions that were asked, you know, if you want a gotcha question to ask a candidate in the first 50 minutes, if ABC has decided all they're going to ask are gotcha questions, you know, this is actually a financial relationship with somebody who is running a campaign. It seems a whole lot more significant than having served on a board with Bill Ayers years ago, or having somebody as your pastor. But no, that's not a gotcha direction that they wanted to go at all, because it had to do with the big money machine in Washington, D.C.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. This is really and truly strange. I just have to share this with you. And a tip of the hat to whomever in the chat room, it's been a while, scrolled off, shared this with us a few hours ago. This is from one of the Russian news services. So keep in mind, it was originally translated from Russian into Spanish and then from Spanish into English, and that's how it's made its way around the blog. I think it was Blue in Missouri, blueinmo-linksoftheday.blogspot.com is where I finally found it. And thanks, Blue, for this. And the headline, nuclear fuel explosion reported in U.S. Midwest. You've heard the news reports that there were earthquakes in Illinois, 5.2, 5.4 magnitude earthquakes. Well, here's the story by Sorcha Fall, as reported to her Western subscribers from Russia. Reports from Third Army headquarters of the Russian Space Command, located in Solzhenitsyn-Nagorsk, Moscow Oblast, are reporting today that a nuclear-fueled explosion has occurred in the United States region of Illinois after the downing of an American B-52 bomber by, presumed, other elements of the U.S. Air Force operating in that region. So powerful was the explosion reported from this downed American nuclear bomber that Western propaganda media sources are reporting the effects of a 5.2 to 5.4 magnitude earthquake in that region. These reports further state that this was the second attempt by a U.S. B-52 nuclear bomber to penetrate the North American Command air defenses surrounding the dissident United States Scott Air Force Base located in Illinois, from which these aircraft seeking to bomb Iranian atomic facilities are based. On Tuesday, April 15th, you get this? What they're saying is that there is this dissident Air Force Base in Illinois, Scott Air Force Base, that is trying to send bombers to Iran, and others within the U.S. military are shooting down these bombers as we try to send them off, and one of them caused this boom. On Tuesday, April 15, American citizens to the Indiana region immediately east of Illinois reported numerous booms and flashes in their night skies, which some attributed to fireball meteorites crashing into the atmosphere, but which the United States Air Force reported was caused by F-16 fighter jets, sonic booms, and the use of military flares. And they point to an actual U.S. news story about that. Their reports, however, state that this April 15 incident turned back the first abortive attempt by dissident American forces to smuggle their plundered nuclear weapons out of that country, that would be the United States, for their intended use against Iran. The trigger for these last desperate attempts to embroil the world in total war arose from the U.S. Defense Secretary's ordering of a full accounting of all nuclear weapons, American nuclear weapons, on March 28th, after the discovery that an unspecified number of them were, quote, missing, end quote. The first attempt to use these missing nuclear weapons against Iran, we had previously reported in our April 5th report entitled U.S. Nuclear B-1 Bomber on Iran Attack Run Shot Down, which occurred over Qatar. So that's the story that they're hearing in Russia, is that there is a war going on within the United States Air Force over whether or not they're going to allow a bomber to go to Iran and drop nukes on Iran. Very strange. And what's even stranger is that I would suspect for many people in Russia and in other parts of the world, they would read that story and go, yep, makes perfect sense. Debbie in New Jersey. Hey, Debbie, welcome to the program. What's up?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a little nervous, but anyway, I tried to get on earlier when Bernie was on, but there's, with the war funding, with the funding of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
The Democrats want to add on funding in that bill that would carry the funding through June 2009 so that
right.
They don't have to vote again in September.
Yeah, and that, the politically that makes sense.
Well, how so? Because how do we know that they're going to do the right thing with it?
What they're saying is that they know that, and Chris, can you please pot Debbie down just a little bit? Because that feedback sounds awful and it's making me crazy. What they're saying is that politically they know that that if there is a vote on Iraq between now and the end of the year, that there's going to be enormous political pressure on the Democrats to say, okay, no more funding, and essentially to leave George W. Bush high and dry. And yet at the same time, They know that Bush will veto that. It'll turn into a huge political ruckus. You're going to have Democrats, you know, kind of caught in the crossfire. I mean, this is the kind of thing that the Republicans would frankly love to have happen. And because the bottom line is Bush is not going to end the war. He has enough funding in other parts of the military, if he needed to, that he could pull out and fund the war. So it will become essentially a symbolic vote. And what the Democrats, I'm assuming what their strategy is, you know, let's forget all this symbolic vote stuff and all this politically charged stuff, and let's just wait until next year when we have a Democratic president, and we'll take care of it. Makes sense, Debbie?
Well, it makes sense. I mean, it sounds good. You just get nervous, you know, because, like, all of a sudden, you know, they say one thing and another thing happens. You know, you just can't trust them unless you stay on top of them, like, you know, a mother with an infant.
Yeah. Debbie, thanks for the call. Your point is well taken. And I would say in the Senate, I am very, very disappointed that Harry Reid has not been. And Bernie Sanders has said the same thing, not about Harry Reid. But, you know, we agree that on these issues, the leadership, which is Harry Reid, should be requiring the Republicans, rather than saying, hey, you've only got 53 votes, you only have 55 votes, you only have 58 votes, you don't have the 60 votes necessary to break a filibuster. And so the Democrats say, okay, we'll move on. I mean, they did this with card check, they've done it with the war, they've done it with a whole bunch of things. And instead, what they should say is, huh, you want a filibuster? The floor is yours. We'll sit here and listen to you talk. You can talk for the next week if you want. And actually force a filibuster. In the House of Representatives, it's a little more complex. Nancy Pelosi has a 30-some-odd vote majority. I think it's a 32 or 36-vote majority in the House of Representatives over Republicans, Democrats over Republicans. But more than 40 of those Democrats in the House of Representatives represent districts that heavily vote Republican. And so she has the problem of a number of members of the Democratic caucus, of the, you know, the Democrats in the House of Representatives, who can't always side with the Democrats if they want to get reelected every 2 years. And so she's trying to herd cats, and that's a tough one. And so the bottom line is that presidential leadership is really necessary. And that's why it's so important that Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton be the president in 2009. And thus, you know, the reason why we all need to get politically active on this thing and get out there on this. John in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, John. Sure.
The way ABC handled the debate, of course, was deplorable. Quite frankly, it doesn't surprise me. I think Hillary Clinton got the same treatment. And by the way, I'm planning to vote for Barack Obama in the primary, Pennsylvania primary. But Hillary Clinton got the same treatment by Gibson and or not Gibson, but Tim Russert and Williams. When she was dogpiled in one of the early Democratic debates.
Well, and she's been getting the same treatment for the better part of 15 years.
Well, and it's look, Democratic presidential candidates have been getting this treatment, period.
Right.
Character is what a person does. It consists of a person's actions and how they treat other people and how they handle difficult issues. But the right has decided to make character, you know, about isolated statements that a person might make.
Or appearances. Remember the Michael Dukakis ad where it showed Michael Dukakis in the tank with a hat on, and the cut
right.
line underneath it was, America can't afford this kind of leadership?
Right.
Like,
I mean,
what?
The right has made this about, because they've developed a very effective attack machine, you know, whose members are very good at taking statements out of context or exaggerating their meaning or, you know, pinpointing certain, you know, specific mannerisms, or emphasizing the importance of some sort of, you know, relationship the person has, and then reading all sorts of sinister implications as to the person's character from that. And the mainstream media, for whatever reason, laziness, being intimidated by the right, corporate ownership, they've picked up on this and they use it as their frame. But they only use it against Democrats. Only use it against Democrats. For example, if we want to talk about, and I tried calling into a conservative show last night when they were talking about Reverend Wright and other figures that, you know, well, if a politician associates with a figure like that, then, you know, they should be just, you know, banned from holding public office, because that shows just, you know.
So let's talk about John Hagee. You know, let's talk about Jerry Falwell with his.
Serious before the killing stops. And I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
I mean, you know.
I wanted to, when I was calling in, I tried to bring up, I wanted to bring up if they would have put me on air, Vandar Bush. Did George W. Bush get this kind of criticism because of his friendship with Vandar Bush, the man he, the member of the House of Saud, the royal family of Saud he held hands with?
The guy who was doing fundraisers for Sunni terrorist groups?
Yeah, he's a virulent, I mean, the entire House of Saud, I mean, look, I can't speak to every individual member, but they're anti-Israel, they're anti-Semitic, they're anti-Christian, they treat women like second-class citizens.
Yep.
They turn a blind eye to human rights violations, and, I mean, they're monarchists, they're dictators.
That's right, that's absolutely right, and the media has completely ignored it. John, you're so spot on right, and I thank you for the call. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com for our live chat room. At the Tom Hartmann Program here on Air America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
There's a price for freedom and a price for truth, and money doesn't bleed red, white, and blue.
Our phone number, Melissa in Mountain Home, Idaho. Thanks for calling, Melissa. What's up?
Oh, you know, just wanted to talk about the news. I mean, geez, what's been going on with that lately?
Yeah. You mean the fact that our news is now infotainment instead of news?
Well, let me just ask a quick question. I mean, back in high school many years ago, yellow journalism, is that not rampant?
That, what we call mainstream journalism has become what used to be referred to as tabloid journalism.
I mean, I'm 32 and I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was my fantastic birthday yesterday with my wonderful parents who are probably listening.
Well, happy birthday, Melissa.
Well, thanks. But yeah, it's just maddening for the American people. You can't find anything.
Yeah.
And when you find it, I mean... You know, it's not news.
Right. And it's, you know, it's unfortunate that we have to use the Internet to actually find out what's going on. That's kind of the downside of it. The upside of it is that the Internet is holding the media accountable increasingly. But there, frankly, I think that there should be a level of accountability that has to do with, you know, what is the best thing for democracy? It's, as de Tocqueville pointed out in 1836, as Jefferson pointed out, a free society cannot exist without a free press. And we don't have a free press. We have a profit press. We have a corporate press. And either, you know, one of two things, either massively enforcing the Sherman Act or re-regulating to the extent to say, you know, programming in the public interest is an important thing. Melissa, thank you for the call, and thank you.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. I just want to remind the American people real quick that, you know, if you don't know what's going on or what this country was founded on, just read the first line in the Constitution.
There you go. Yeah. And in fact, it's such an important thing. The preamble to the Constitution is the six things that are laid out in the preamble to the Constitution, in order to form a more perfect union, number one. A more perfect union. What, you know, that has meaning, and it has liberal meaning. Establish justice. Ensure domestic tranquility. Provide for the common defense. That's the only part that the cons really hang to. Oh, yeah, we got to have an army. Promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. I mean, that's just... straightforward stuff, just straightforward stuff. Jeff in Tacoma. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to touch on the debate again. I know we've been really beating it to death, but to me it seemed like the Republican Party had hijacked our Democratic nominating contest, and I'm just amazed that the Democratic Party continues to let the corporate media run the show. I think we should be on PBS and NPR and more independent outlets. You know, we shouldn't just try to go for the most viewers, because this is what we're going to get.
Yeah, well, you know, Mark Green with this network offered to host the Republican debates, and I think it would have been fascinating to get the Republicans all there and say, okay, you know, how about the lobbyists who are running your campaigns? How about the big corporations who are giving you money? You know, how about your association with Hagee? Chris in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you want to disagree with me?
I'm going to disagree with you. I'm going to give you a couple points here. I actually agree with a lot of stuff you say, but number one, a few months back when the Republicans had their debate on CNN, there was that big to-do about questions being asked by Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
How come MoveOn.org wasn't upset about that, or you weren't upset about that?
There were Democrats asking questions.
On CNN.
What was the question?
It was several months ago, Tom.
Yeah. See, I'm sorry. My memory is as bad as yours is, Chris. I don't remember a specific question that was asked to the Republicans that seemed out of bounds.
It was the gotcha questions. Two, you had a caller come up, make a comment about taking quotes out of context. Is this not the same thing that happened to Trent Lott? When he said, if Strom Thurmond would have been president, things would be different.
What he said was, we wouldn't have had all these problems all these years.
So
which
was out of context, right?
Well, no, I think it was in context, and Trent Lott essentially admitted that it was. that was a little different. Trent Lott he did apologize for it, and he did back away from it. So, yeah, I think that, fair enough.
I just think it's, again, on both sides, it's just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, enough gotcha politics, in other words. Let's talk about the real issues.
Well, no, you know, I think it would be much better served in this country if you took away the party affiliation, and then each person would have to indicate what their views and positions are on the issues so that you can actually make a good choice. Because
although what's happened is that the party affiliation is the basket, it's the frame, it's the packaging for that set of perspectives.
Each side has their own special interests, corporations big time with the GOP, plaintiff attorneys, unions with the Democrats. Everyone's shaking hands under the table.
Right. I don't disagree, but the plaintiff's attorneys are looking out for the little guy, and the unions are democracies that work on behalf of labor. The big corporations, it used to be that everybody understood that the GOP was all about the fat cats and the millionaires and billionaires. But since Reagan, the GOP has reinvented itself as saying, we're with the little guy. How are you, the little guy? Well, we want to make sure that you can have a gun in the back of your truck. And it's like, wait a minute, I think the little guy would much rather know that they're going to have some job security. The little guy would much rather know that if they get sick, they're not going to get wiped out. But the Republicans, they're legislating on an economic agenda, but they talk about things like abortion and gun rights and things like this, but they never legislate them. Right. They're not going to actually push those buttons. They're not going to go down those roads because they need to keep those issues alive and keep those hot. And this whole Lee Atwater strategy of dividing people over these so-called lifestyle issues and gay marriage and things like this, getting gay marriage on ballots so that it'll draw out the homophobes and the right wingers so that while they happen to be in the booth, they'll vote for Republican. I mean, these kind of strategies are downright destructive. And to the extent that Democrats may participate in them, I will agree with you. I would condemn them. I think it's time for us to all honestly talk about what the issues are. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Call 866-303-2270. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Taking your calls on any topic you'd like to bring up. John in Marin County, California. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. I listened to you and Bernie talk a lot about the universal health care, single-payer health care, and often Scandinavia and Denmark in particular come up in the conversation. And I've lived here, I was born here, but half my family's from Denmark and I've lived there. And I've experienced the healthcare over there, and a couple of our family members are physicians over there, and it works really, really well, and worked well for everybody. But I understand you're going over there shortly.
In June.
For a visit. Yeah. And there's a lot of other things they do well over there, and this is just a couple that I understand, is they've used their royalties from North Sea Oil, managed them really well so that they can benefit the country, and they're becoming energy self-sufficient with that and wind energy. And any information and discussion about that would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, well, thank you, and I will be looking into that. John, thanks for the call, and thanks for the I'm sorry, John, I didn't realize you had more to say. And also, Sweden, you know, has imposed $150 a ton, I think, or maybe it's $140 a ton carbon tax. They did this a couple of years ago, and they are now saying that they are moving their rate of growth of their alternative energy industry is triple that of the United States, and they are now saying that by 2020 they will be independent of oil. They will be off the carbon economy. Now, just in that context, let me share with you Jimmy Carter, July 15, 1979.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And it would have worked if Reagan hadn't come along.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
By the year 2000. Doesn't it bring tears to your eyes? And then Reagan comes in, and what does he do? He takes the solar collectors off the roof of the White House. He rolls back Carter's legislation. He rolls back Carter's tax breaks and tax cuts and supports and subsidies for the solar industry, and increases supports and tax breaks and subsidies for the oil and nuclear industries. And here we are. Jeremy in Michigan. Hey, Jeremy.
Hello, Tom.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just watched The 11th Hour yesterday.
Oh, and Leonardo DiCaprio's movie.
It floored me. It was great.
Yeah, I agree. It's very well done.
And I wanted to call and get your opinion on, I know you talk about the solar program in Germany a lot,
mm-hmm.
and get your opinion on what you think the possibility of doing that on a local level in the States would be. Or is that something that would have to go through the federal government? Because I don't think we can wait for the feds, you know?
Right, yeah. It could be done at a state level, particularly in those states where, or even at a municipal level, particularly in those areas where you have a municipality or you have a state or you have a county that owns the utility, where you have publicly owned power. Publicly owned power is more than 50% of all the power in the United States, but it's scattered all over the place.
Yeah, we've got our own power plant, and they're putting turbines in along the train tracks here. So I saw the movie, and I thought about that. You talk about that program a lot,
it's a very straightforward thing, Jeremy. And the way that they do it in Germany is you buy a solar system for your house. You know, put solar panels on your roof, and it increases the value of your house. Let's say you buy a $20,000 solar system. The bank is required to loan you that $20,000 at a very, very low rate of interest. I think it's 2%. The bank will not lose money on that because the government guarantees the loan to the bank. So if you default, the bank has no risk. Since they have no risk and they have minimal paperwork, you know, even at 2%, they're making a profit. So they have to give you a mortgage for that. At the same time, the power company has to buy electricity from you at 7 times the going rate. And they've done the math on this, so it works out that the power that you're selling back to the electric company typically is equivalent, given the efficiency of solar panels these days, is equivalent to the amount that you're paying every month in your mortgage payments over a 10-year period for your solar panels on your roof plus the interest. So essentially, the solar panels are costing you nothing. At the end of 10 years, the utility no longer has to pay you 700%. They simply have to pay you 100% of the cost. In other words, you sell electricity, you can run your meter backwards. And you can 90% is solar or 50% is solar and the rest is coming down the power lines. And you have paid off the loan on a solar system that has a 50-year lifespan. So you've got a 50-year asset in your house. It has cost you nothing. And in the meantime, all these solar panels all over Germany have generated, just in the last 6-8 years since they first started this program, they are now generating so much solar power in a country that is one of the cloudiest and gloomiest countries in the European continent. I can tell you, I lived there in Stadtsteinach, where I lived in 86. I remember on the radio, the local DJ was counting the days. We had 91 days in a row where the sun never came out. And, you know, in the late winter and spring. And, I mean, this is one of the cloudiest places in the Northern Hemisphere. And it's right up there with the Pacific Northwest here. And yet they have generated so much electricity that they didn't need to build two new nuclear power plants, which they were intending to build. And that was the whole point. So Jeremy's spot on. It can be done, and it could be done by a municipality, or it could be done by a state in a way very similar to that. If they could figure out a way to, either they'd have to float a bond fund so that they would be the lender, because I doubt that they could force that kind of thing on banks. That's going to require federal regulators. And if their local utility would buy back the electricity at that higher rate in exchange for not having to build out more generating capacity. So, you know, it's a pretty straightforward balance, I think. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. And tomorrow's Earth Day, and I want to wish you and your audience a happy Earth Day tomorrow.
Thank you, and happy Earth Day to you, Harvey. I remember when it was a big deal. You know, it was...
I believe it will be again.
Hopefully.
Once Obama gets in. And what I want to talk about is that every day, I have a new idea for renewable energy. It may not be a new idea, but every day millions of Americans stay in shape by going to local gyms. And I say, why not turn those gyms into electro gyms? Because any kind of physical motion can be made into electricity. And so you can have electro Stairmaster, electro bike, electro rower. Mm-hmm. And as the people go from machine to machine, they're given a card. They put the card in the machine, and it records how much electricity they made. And at the end of the month, you know, they take it out of that machine, they put in another machine, and so on and so forth. And then at the end of the month, they turn in the card for rebates.
Against their gym membership?
What's that? Yeah.
Against the fee of their membership in the gym?
Membership, rebates, all sorts of things like that, including maybe even paying off their utility bill. So I say it's time to get into shape and save the world. And
there's an entrepreneurial opportunity. You know, Harvey, I suspect that somewhere out there listening to us right now is somebody who owns a piece of a gym, or is thinking about, gee, I ought to start a business. What should I start? And I think that's a great idea. That is an entrepreneurial opportunity. See, the question when you're starting a business is always, what is my unfair competitive advantage? How can I differentiate my business from all other businesses so that people will patronize me instead of them? And you just laid out a brilliant one. Absolutely laid out a brilliant one. Al in Pittsburgh. Hey, Al, what's up?
Yeah, I was wondering, the Senate is controlled by the Democrats, and yet they're not doing anything. They're like they're going to get laid at their feet, the do-nothing Senate. And,
right. And the Republicans have said that this is their strategy. I mean, they've publicly, the Republican caucus has said that in public, that they're going to use the filibuster to prevent the Democrats from passing meaningful legislation, and then in the election they're going to run against a do-nothing Congress.
But if you're going to filibuster, why don't they rise up to their full height and make them stand there and filibuster? I agree,
and Bernie Sanders agrees, and there's a couple other members of the Senate who agree. Russ Feingold agrees. Convince Harry Reid.
But nobody's doing it. So
Harry Reid is the guy who makes the call.
Leadership that's really dropping the ball, and they deservedly should get blamed for the do-nothing then.
That's my personal opinion. Harry Reid's a very nice guy. He's a brilliant legislator. He does a great job of representing his home state of Nevada. But I would frankly much rather see Russ Feingold or Barbara Boxer or for that matter, if she doesn't win the presidential nomination, Hillary Clinton as the leader of the Senate in the 2009, you know, congressional session. I'm sorry. Harry Reid has, in my opinion, dropped too many opportunities to stand up to the Republicans in ways even symbolic. And frankly, we can't ignore symbolism in the United States. I mean, Newt Gingrich turned this into a fine art, you know, with his contract on America and all that stuff. I mean, we could have done that. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Janice in Massachusetts, listening to WHMP. Hey, Janice, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm a first-time caller, so I'm going to be a little nervous here.
That's okay.
I'm calling to run this by you and ask you some questions about it. I don't know if you saw the article on the Huffington Post on April 16th by Sam Stein.
I don't recall.
Hillary Clinton and Southern working class whites in 1995, screw them.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I did see that.
You did see that.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, why isn't the media picking this story up? It just seems like it's below the radar.
It has been completely ignored. In fact, the story came out before the debates. I was expecting it to be thrown at Hillary Clinton during the debate, and I was surprised that it wasn't.
Yeah.
I think that it hasn't been picked up by the media because it hasn't been driven into the media. The Obama comments about bitterness would have probably been ignored by the media if the Clinton campaign had not picked them up and pounded them. Speaking as a member of the media, I get the daily emails from both campaigns. You know, we're invited occasionally to participate, usually to participate in the daily conference calls with the campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
The campaigns themselves basically drive. You know, they say, this is what we're talking about. This is what our candidate is talking about. This is what we think the big issue is. And the media goes, okay, okay, okay. And the Obama campaign, to the best of my knowledge, at no point has taken this, you know, something at that level of frivolity,
mm-hmm.
you know, of Hillary Clinton in 95. You know, there was, and for our listeners who don't know what we're talking about, there was a meeting. This is documented in a couple of books, and it's also been testified to by several people who were at the meeting.
Correct.
There was a strategy meeting that had to do with, you know, what are we going to do for the 96 elections? And somebody asked the question, what about the Reagan Democrats? What about the blue-collar working white folks who have moved over to the Republican side? You know, should we have an outreach to them? And Hillary Clinton said, screw them.
You don't owe them a thing, Bill. They're doing nothing for you. You don't have to do anything for them.
That's the quote from the article and from the book. And the people who were there say, yes, in fact, she said that. I don't think that that should be held against her. I don't think that that's an issue. She was making a decision at the time that she thought was an appropriate political decision. And that's what you do in politics. And just as I don't think that this whole, you know, bitter thing should be held against Barack Obama, he was inartful in the way he said it. But what he said was essentially the thesis of Tom Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And frankly, I was surprised. I expected the Clinton campaign to endorse what Obama said and say,
exactly.
Yes, these people are hurt and they are bitter. And Hillary Clinton has a long tradition of fighting for the little guy. And she's the better one than Barack Obama to fight for them because she has. Look at all these legislative victories that she's had in her 6-7 years now in the Senate. That's what I was expecting. I was just totally astounded when we got the talking points that, oh, you know, Obama is, you know, trashing, you know, people in small town America. So I think that the reason that the Clinton story, the story, which is obviously real and has been verified, of Hillary Clinton saying screw them about, you know, white middle class, or working class folks, has not been picked up by the media is because the Obama campaign has not touched it with a 10-foot pole. They're not running that kind of campaign.
Yeah. Well, that's good for them, but I think it speaks to the hypocrisy of Hillary to say that his remarks were elitist and demeaning when she, you know, she put this forth.
Yeah, I agree, and that's the kind of campaign that she's chosen to run and that Mark Pena has suggested that she run, and maybe that's the kind of campaign that you have to run in order to win in the United States, and
that's
you know, that's all the more the problem, and that's the tragedy. Janice, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call, and thanks for raising that issue. I thought about raising it a couple times myself, and then I thought, well, you know, I don't want to be the guy who's making this gratuitous thing. But you brought it up so we could talk about it. Flo in Sunrise, Florida, listening on Winds. Hey, Flo.
Hi, Mr. Hartman.
Hi, I'm Tom.
Hi, Tom. I just on a business report this morning that Citigroup posted its second $5.1 billion loss, second quarterly report. And then later they said the stock market was up because they had higher than expected earnings. So what goes with that?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Are they the Saudis, Citigroup?
The Saudis own a good chunk of Citigroup. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that it's a majority percentage, but they may be one of the larger. They are certainly one of the larger stockholders, and they may be larger to the point that they have like a controlling interest. Like the Ford family, I think they own like 4 or 5% of Ford Motor Company, but it's enough to effectively control the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Citicorp, you know, took a huge hit with the mortgage write-downs and mortgage losses.
That's what they said.
But
here's a sad, I wanted to tell you a sad story here in Florida.
Sure.
Father and the son were walking home. The father went to a blood bank, got $20 to save $5 for cab fare. They walked home, and his 16-year-old son was hit by a train.
Oh, my.
These are the kind of stories I want our representatives to hear.
I don't
I think they seem to be in another world. Not Bernie Sanders. There's a handful of them that I do like.
Yeah.
But if you call to say something, they seem to have very little time for you. Like they
they've got to deal with 35,000 lobbyists. I mean, seriously, there are twice as many lobbyists in Washington, D.C. as there were when Bill Clinton came into office. And then, and at that point, there were twice as many lobbyists as there were when Ronald Reagan came into office.
And John McCain is.
Yeah, he's got nothing but lobbyists from top to bottom throughout his campaign. Flo, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, you go back to the 1950s during the time that Dwight Eisenhower was president and when John Kennedy became president, there were, as I recall, fewer than 300 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C. There's 35,000 of them right now, if my recollections are correct. 27 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. So through the night rode Paul Revere, and so through the night went his cry of alarm to every Middlesex village and farm, a cry of defiance and not of fear. A voice in the darkness, a knock at the door, and a word that shall echo evermore. For born in the wind night of the past, through all our history to the last, in the hour of darkness and peril and need, the people will awaken and listen to hear the hurrying hoofbeats of that steed and the midnight message of Paul Revere. Isn't that extraordinary? Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. On the 18th of April in 75, today the day, to every Middlesex village and farm, a cry of defiance and not of fear. And now we have the wimpiest, most pathetic, fear-ridden president and administration I have ever seen in my entire life. Oh, be afraid, be afraid, be more afraid, be even more afraid. I mean, you gotta be afraid.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive.
I mean, this is just from his speech at the RNC.
Danger. Doom killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy. May God bless you. Evil God. Iraq. Darkness. The continuing danger of terrorism.
This is, these are all just clips from Bush's keynote address in 2004 at the Republican National Convention.
And nothing will hold us back.
Be afraid.
And we will prevail. Be afraid. God bless America. Nuclear weapons. Iraq was a gathering threat, and Al-Qaeda was largely unchallenged as it planned attacks. Free Afghanistan, terror. Pakistan, terrorists. Saudi Arabia.
And on it goes. It goes on for, I got 2.5 minutes of that. Patrick in Monterey, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I got a few things I wanted to bring up, and actually some questions, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, yesterday, I think Ellen Ratner was on talking about a GAO report that mentions multiple terrorist attacks potentially in the U.S., and I was wondering if there's a link or where to pick that up.
I would go over to talkradionews.com. Usually there are links there to the stories that she talks about.
Talkradionews.com. Okay. I had a request at the end of my comments. I think it was a week or two ago on Sam Cedar, he mentioned someone he knew or someone who he's talked to who said that he served in Vietnam at the same time that McCain served. And in 1967, he was on an aircraft carrier and saw McCain and said, how goes the war, John? And McCain smiled at him, gave him the thumbs up, and said, well, at least this war is better than not having any war at all. And Sam said he wasn't going to have this guy on the show. I don't know if you'd consider it. I would like to see this guy on Good Morning America. I don't care if he's fully vetted. Considering all the swift voting that's probably going to happen with Obama or Hillary, I want certain things to stick to McCain like Velcro. Warmonger, you know, from Schultz. I'm glad he's sticking to his guns on that. He's too old. He has senior moments confusing Shias and Sunnis. And I don't care.
Patrick, there's going to be plenty of time for all this stuff. Trust me, there's going to be plenty of time for all this stuff. And although you're right, we need to start identifying John McCain, because John McCain is out there trying to identify himself, trying to brand himself and pull back that brand. The media just loves this idea. Oh, he's the maverick. He's the good guy. No. He's not. And as to, you know, what Sam is doing or any other talk show host, I'm, you know, I don't know. Sean in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Tom, I saw you on Kudlow & Company last year, and I know you're a regular reader of the Financial Times of London, so I have tremendous respect for your opinions on economic issues. Tom, I've been trying to think of how our current financial crisis parallels events of the past, and just very quickly, I'm thinking of the 29 crash where you had members of the public buying on margin, whereas today you have brokerages using leverage, so people buying stock, you know, by borrowing money.
And members of the public are buying on margin as well. It's just that instead of buying stocks, they're buying homes.
Exactly. And then the second, of course, would be long-term capital management, that huge trillion-dollar hedge fund of derivatives, speculating on, you know, minuscule changes in currencies. And, you know, basically those are the quant funds. Am I correct on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe so, yeah.
And then thirdly, the accounting scandals like Enron and WorldCom, they were doing mark-to-market, mark-to-model, and today they're doing mark-to-mystery. You know,
that's
they don't
right.
even know what these...
Well, and in fact, you've got, you know, I mean, there are some very serious questions being raised about Moody's and other bond rating funds. I think that there's only three now large certified bond rating funds. And, you know, again, bring in the Sherman Act. Break them up. Let's have some real competition. Let's have some real accountability.
Well,
because they were rating some of these funds as A, AA, AAA when, you know, nobody had ever actually combed through the books.
That's right. Supposedly we had Sarbanes-Oxley. But my question for you, Tom, is basically, do you think there's any credence to the idea that we're on the precipice of a super bubble, that
yes.
a perfect economic storm is underway?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think that there is at least a 50% chance that within 18 months to 2 years, and perhaps as soon as 6 months, that we will be in something that's going to very, very closely resemble the Great Depression of 1929, 1930, et cetera, or the Panic of 1896, or the Panic of 1846, or the Panic of 1770, whatever year it was. I think it was, no, 1768, I think it was. It just preceded the American Revolution. There have been a series of these things, and they, by and large, they all share the same characteristics. And Ravi Batra actually writes about this in his book, The New Golden Age, and he says, you know, there's going to be this disaster, and then out of that is going to come another FDR, and there's going to come another New Deal, and we're going to put it back together. Sean, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call and for your comments. Peter in Homestead, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Peter.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to. I really do support you, just like many liberals do. Single payer health plan in America. But my question for you: how would you feel would be the best way to implement it? Since we have, like, I'm guessing dozens of private insurance companies, and I guess you'd have to dismantle them, and you have millions of people working for them. Like, how would you think, if we're ever to go in that direction, be able to implement it?
If we look, Peter, at the experience of other countries that have single-payer health care or that have some variation on that, that have national health care, and you look back at the times when those programs came into being, they actually stimulate economic activity massively. There was a case, it was a front page of the Wall Street Journal. This was about 5 years ago, as I recall. I think it was the first year or maybe the second year that we had started this radio program. So it either would have been 6 or 5 years ago. We were living back in Vermont at the time. And Toyota, as I recall, though it could have been Honda, but I think it was Toyota, was looking to site a new auto factory in the United States. And there were three states. It had come down to a competition among three states. And my recollection is that Alabama thought they'd gotten it. And the states were offering them hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks. They were offering them free land. They were offering all kinds of, you know, I mean, just you know, falling all over themselves and giving away the store in order to bring in this auto company. And at the last minute, the company decided to locate their auto plant in southern Canada, near Toronto. And when asked why, they came out and they said the reason why is because in Canada we don't have to pay the cost of health care. And the cost of health care would have been greater in the United States to the workers than would have been all the tax breaks that were offered, and in Canada we don't have that cost. Our health care system is making us economically uncompetitive. And if we were to fix it, those thousands or tens of thousands of people whose main job right now is to take your phone call when you call your insurance company and say, why didn't you pay this bill? And to say, well, sorry, Charlie, we're not going to pay it. Whose main job is to turn down payments. All those people would be able to find other jobs in other areas because there would be so much demand for people because there would be an economic expansion as a consequence of that. I mean, it's just pretty straightforward stuff. Darby in Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Darby, what's up?
Hey, well, listen, I just discovered you on C-SPAN probably 6 months ago, and I just started listening to you on Air America a couple of weeks ago, and I really appreciate everything you do.
Thank you. You hit on a
story earlier today that I would like to find a link or something to it when you were talking about the Russian reports basically saying that earthquakes are not earthquakes.
Yeah, that those earthquakes in Illinois were actually a rogue element in the U.S. Military stopping another rogue element in the U.S. military from sending nukes over to Iran. I don't take it seriously. We'll put the link on our homepage. I'll do that within the next hour or so. I'll find the story and get it on there, okay?
Okay,
so you can track it back. Sure. Thank you, Darby, and appreciate the call. Jackie in Houston. Hey, Jackie, you got about a minute here before we got to take a break. What's up? Jackie?
Who is it?
It's Jackie. You're on the air.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Yeah, a couple of things. There were some real good articles in one of the major newspapers, I think the New York Times, about the geothermal energy being used in Iceland as being very, very...
Iceland is 100% energy independent right now.
Yeah. Listen, one of the things I really wanted to say was about the onslaught of the pundits toward Obama about saying that it was toughening him up and making him withstand the onslaught, the Republican onslaught. But to me, it felt like saying that's like beating a woman and raping her so she can get prepared for the outside world. I mean, these were journalists, or should have been, instead of Republicans that should not have been serving him on a platter to Hillary.
I agree with you, Jackie. I think that the metaphor is imperfect, but and you can probably build a case on either side, and that's why it's an imperfect metaphor, but it's sure. Not one that I would totally disown. I think your point is well made. Thank you very much for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. TomHartmann.com. Drop into our live chat room, 866-303-2270.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom. For me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to Louise Hartman, my producer Sean Taylor, our executive producer Sean Taylor, to Chris Rosen, to Lauren Kirshner, Sean Kensing, and Marcus Hillman at Air America, and all the folks there who helped make this show possible, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives and our website. To our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. And thanks to Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service for providing us with a brilliant daily newscast, and all the folks associated with Talk Radio News and Michael Harrison and whatnot. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, you know, every once in a while I like to give you the chutzpah department. Today I give it to the Republican leadership, the House Republican Conference. They have a new web video. It's called the Pelosi Premium, the soaring gas prices, and they're talking about her 2006 promise to bring down gas prices, which they say are $1.11 higher than when she became Speaker. How do you put this on Nancy Pelosi? It's beyond my wildest comprehension.
That really,
they win our chutzpah award this week.
I will vote for that. By the way, I need to toss something in here. A couple of days ago, somebody called into the show and said, Barack Obama was not a professor of law, and I shouldn't say that. Nobody should say that, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Certainly was. He was an adjunct.
Actually, I'm looking at the University of Chicago Law School's website. You can see it at law.uchicago.edu/media/index, and it says The law school has received many media requests about Barack Obama, especially about his status as senior lecturer. From 1992 until his election to the U.S. Senate in 2004, Barack Obama served as a professor in the law school, period. So,
right.
There you go. That's right from the University of Chicago Law School. Just to set the record straight.
A lecturer, which is equivalent to an adjunct, which is a professor.
Right. I didn't understand that distinction. I thought professor, like in the UK, was a title that, you know, is a very, very distinguished. You have to, you know, work your butt off. It's like being tenured and all that kind of thing. I didn't realize that he was a professor of the law school. So I stand corrected, and I had a bunch of emails from listeners about it. And I keep, every day for the last 3 days, I've been meaning to mention it, and I keep forgetting. And so I just did now. So anyhow, back to the news.
Okay, quite a few other things going on. First of all, I want to talk about the Obama endorsements. You know, a lot of people think he's a liberal. Well, he got two endorsements from two people who are not exactly liberal. Sam Nunn, who was chair of armed services and a senator from 72 to 97. David Bourne, I believe he's from Oklahoma. I think he's president of the university there, or was. 79 to 94, longest serving chair on the Senate Select Committee. And last but not least, somebody who I remember having a conversation with at the 96 convention, who had just left the Department of Labor and pretty much did it over the welfare issue, although he was not verbal about it at the time, and that is Secretary Robert Reich.
Wow. You know,
all in the Obama camp.
Yeah, we, Louise and I and our kids lived in Atlanta and Georgia from 83 until, 96, I guess, when we moved to Vermont, and with the exception of a year in Germany. And during that 13 years, most of that, Sam Nunn was our senator, one of our senators. And he was very highly regarded, even though he was a very kind of pro-military guy and a very conservative Democrat. He was very highly regarded by Georgians, anyway. I got the impression that across the country he was. I think of all those endorsements, that's the one that's going to carry the most weight.
I would completely agree. And Robert Reich, of course, was a Clinton cabinet secretary, as, of course, was Bill Richardson.
Yeah, Robert Reich just came out and endorsed Obama?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, he was the Secretary of Labor in the Clinton
Absolutely.
Cabinet.
Absolutely, and he left after 96. I mean, he didn't say so at the time, but he basically left because of the welfare reform issue.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, he disagreed with it. Robert Reich is that's interesting because Robert Reich is very liberal. Sam Nunn is very conservative, and here both of them are endorsing Barack Obama. I find that fascinating.
Absolutely. A couple other interesting things. The president today announced his new HUD secretary from the SBA, Steve Preston. But what's more interesting is that the current, or until he resigned, Alfonso Jackson was at HUD, and he was there. And the president called him a dedicated, decent man, a compassionate man who worked tirelessly at HUD.
Hmm. Yeah. Tirelessly for what? To have his oil painting done?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's about it. He had an emergency appropriation for $100,000 to have an oil portrait of him done. And as far as I know, and last spring he said, oh, don't worry, there's nothing wrong with the housing market. It'll all shake out by the summer. Well, it is.
Oh, that is for sure. The South Koreans, as you know, in addition to the Colombian trade deal, there is a pending trade deal with South Korea, and they're trying to move it along, and they have lifted the import ban on beef from the United States. So that happened today. Speaking of listing things, the National Association of Manufacturers tried to get a federal judge to delay enforcement of a lobbying law. This is a 2007 law where association must disclose every member that contributes $5,000 or more a quarter by April 21st. There's 11,000 members of the National Manufacturing Association.
Yeah, the National Association of Manufacturers president also, this was in the Wall Street Journal a couple of months ago, is quite outspoken about how they were going to basically hand the Republicans their head on a platter, or the Democrats their head on a platter in this election, that they were going to be politically active on behalf of the Republicans if the Democrats started talking about regulating big business.
Well, that's
in
probably why they don't want all their lobbying money going.
That's right. That's right.
The president also spoke at the Small Business Summit. He said we saw this slowdown coming. Then he promoted his package of rebates, and then he said he wants to make tax relief permanent, and he thought that would be a solution.
Yeah, right. Thank you, Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Monday, Carrie Lucas, the Independent Women's Forum. Are women still earning 77 cents to the dollar? And Bob Barr, former Republican congressman from Georgia, is going to be on the program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.